You're listening to WTUL New Orleans, and we have Bruce Riley in the studio. So thank you so much for coming in, Bruce. I know it's kind of early and it's hard to get here, but navigating all this traffic and construction, it even takes me half an hour sometimes, and I just live on the other side of Jefferson. But welcome to WTUL.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, and so there's a documentary coming up on Monday, First Degree. Mm-hmm. I'd love it if you could let listeners know a little bit about that, and also let listeners know a bit about your background and how you ended up here in the city helping us fight for justice for all.
Sure. Well, the short documentary on Monday upstairs at the LBC is called First Degree, and it is about a prison education program in New York called Hudson Link, where a good friend of mine actually works, and I've got to know some of the people that do that program, and it's similar to a program that I started with a couple guys. Well, it's not really similar, but it's addressing the same problem, which is the lack of education opportunities for people who are incarcerated. And so we created a scholarship foundation called Transcending Through Education Foundation, which we call TTEF, for people who are both incarcerated and transitioning out, focusing on higher education, right? Because everyone always just figures like, oh, these guys need GEDs, and if we could just get them, you know, digging ditches when they get out, you know, life will be great. And, you know, it's pretty low bar and disrespectful to, you know, think that, you know, if your son or daughter were incarcerated, you know, the most you'd really want them to strive for and the most they're capable of doing is, let's say, getting a GED and you know, working at McDonald's or something. And that may be a first step considering the oppressive nature of getting out of prison, but it shouldn't be a last stop. So I personally was incarcerated. I think, you know, some folks here at Tulane know me because I came down to New Orleans to go to Tulane Law School. I'm a proud graduate of Tulane Law School. And, you know, at the time I came down here, I'd already been out for 7 years. But of course, to some people, it was, you know, their first meeting of me. And so I struggled to obtain any education while I was on the inside because we didn't have a program that was similar to Hudson Link, which is the subject of the short documentary. And, you know, I got maybe like 28 credits. Most of them were these sort of they call them Dantes now, but they're like college level equivalency type tests. And, you know, I would knock them out like $50 here, $50 there. And then none of them, I think three of them were three credits were accepted when I tried to transfer into an undergraduate degree after I got out, and I never actually finished the undergraduate degree, and then I went to law school, which people trip out on.
Right, I mean, people never expect that, you know, and it's interesting because you know when you serve time in a prison, or unfortunately people are spending way too much time in a jail, what do you do with your time, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, I guess that is the difference between jails and prisons also, right? Like, jails are really just a holding pen until a person is adjudicated and then goes to prison. Once they're in the prison, that's where, if any kind of rehabilitation is actually happening, that's where it's going to happen, right? Not in the jail. So, and I think people are, they get confused, I think, between what prisons and jails are. You know, people just read about stuff in the paper, and it's like they equate them as the same thing. But I don't think people understand the subtle nuances between, or maybe not so subtle nuances between. So maybe you can opinionate on that a little bit as well, and what's happening in Orleans Parish Prison right now. You know, there's been a dust up around some Orleans Parish Prison Reform Coalition asking, in conjunction with faith-based ministers, asking Sheriff Guzman for his resignation due to poor management practices and, you know, to conditions in the new jail that were supposed to be mitigated when it opened, or at least that's what we were told, as opposed to the former facility, which wasn't even really hardly a facility. It was tents, right? People living in squalor, really. So, if you know, maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I mean, it's funny, you know, you mentioned the difference between jail and prison. Sometimes even people who know very well the difference between jail and prison still just interchange the terms. I mean, I often use the phrase jail in place of prison. You know, I call it the joint. I call it the big house. Call it some other terms that aren't appropriate for the FCC. And you know, the thing with jail, and some people are serving short-term sentences, And a lot of times when you first get locked up, of course, you know, your life is in so much turmoil. And you may be trying to hold on to a job or a relationship or, you know, deal with things that you're going to have to deal with within a few weeks or a few months. And it could be payments you have to make. There may be a car of yours being towed or something like that. You have like $400 in your bank account that you're trying to get out because like every penny is so important at that moment. And so there's all this stuff that's going on, and it's really, really difficult. And if anyone's suffering from substance abuse addictions, well, then that is like its most live and vibrant and painful time too. So it's really hard to rehabilitate oneself. I mean, I don't think that anyone rehabilitates another. You know, it's not something that like the prison administration does unto somebody. And it's, you know, it really has to come from within. And rehabilitation is, in my mind, the number one program is generally, you know, the person next to you, and the person you walk the yard with, the person you play basketball with, the person you discuss the books you read with. And so if you can surround yourself with some decent individuals and kind of strive for more and be curious about life and grow together, you can get some really epic results out of all that you yourself didn't even see coming. And that was, you know, my experience. And I've seen it with other people and having discussed their experiences. And it's really, in a lot of ways, the best thing that the prison administrations can do is get out of the way and stop needling people, stop poking the bear, mm-hmm. stop harassing them. And so, you know, this jail that we have here has historically had really deplorable conditions, lots of people getting assaulted, lots of deaths. You know, there's a level of care that the guards have to do, and then a level of non poking the bear. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to come up with some friendly terms for it, but you know, they mess with people sometimes, right. And it's you know, it's one of
well,
these.
Well, that's all they know how to do, right?
I mean, well, a lot of people who take the job though are not necessarily sadistic evil
bastards. Oh, I agree, but I think, and everyone knows, you know, my issue is the relationship between mental illness and incarceration, mm-hmm. which anything to do with mental illness generally comes under the rubric of behavioral health, and I really. I'm beginning to dislike that term behavior because that's a symptom sometimes of a larger problem. And especially if a person has mental illness and are acting out in a jail or prison, it's not necessarily them acting out. It may be the mental illness that's acting out. But what the deputies see, what the officials see, they're not trained psychologists, psychiatrists, mm-hmm. social workers, or anything like that. What they're trained to do is treat people according to their behavior. They see bad behavior, they punish bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And they think they can punish a person into being good. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, what you're saying about poking the bear, that fits under now a lot. Not everyone has a mental illness. But this idea that you have to punish behavior constantly rather than look at the causes of it, right. And try to mitigate the behavior through looking at the cause rather than just treating the symptom, you know, that's a huge problem, mm-hmm. I think, in the jails and you know, prisons. I mean, once a person gets to prison, you'd think that there would be a better system, but we see the same thing happening in both levels of, you know, corrections facilities and incarcerated individuals. So,
well, it's interesting that, you know, I mean, the sheriff here, you know, he truly believes that if he just had more money, he could, you know, make it go well. And anyone who's ever had like a jalopy of a car, you know, or a money pit of a house, just knows that you can just keep on putting more money into it. And really, unless you really change the structure or start over, you know, all the money you spend is just going to be, you know, just a waste of money. And for instance, you know, the young guy who recently killed himself, you know, obviously suffering from mental illness, to be in that space. And of course, it's like probably potentially one of the most depressing moments anyone could ever be in would be in there. And I don't know what other like life circumstances he might have been dealing with, but then add on sitting in a jail cell. And, you know, we got a letter at Voice the Ex-Offender, Vote, where I work. We got a letter from a guy who was in the cell next door, basically, and gave us a play-by-play of what went down and explained to us how there's these buttons on the wall when people do the rounds, when the guards do the rounds. And that, by pushing that button, that's how you know they did the rounds. And if that button doesn't get pushed, if people are just sitting in, you know, at their desk, and not doing the really basic work.
Mm-hmm. You know, monitoring.
I mean, just walking around.
Right.
I mean, that's not asking for someone to have some advanced degree and like sit down and unpack somebody's mental illness. That's just walking around right. and seeing if somebody's hanging.
Right.
You know, and they weren't doing that. So that's, you know, it's not a you know, it's not a money thing.
Right.
And, you know,
it's a management.
Totally. It's a management. And, you know, there's a lot of, he still has not, as far as I know, and he's coming to a public thing. I want to ask him to bring with him, you know, the court, Judge Afric, you know, because this jail is under a consent decree by the court and monitored by the court, asked him to bring in a detailed list of all the folks who work there, how much money they make and what are their duties. I mean, that was, what, over a month ago?
Yeah.
And, you know, and so what people suspect, and it's probably very true, is you have a lot of people making crazy money with, like, very big sort of, like, middle management, upper management type jobs, and they're not really doing anything, and it's cushy. And so then you could take that same money and pay people to actually do the work. And obviously when one is in control of a large agency of the government, you know, if you told me the taxpayers are buying me the next Lamborghini, I may not care whether it's the $300,000 model, the $200,000 model. I'm just going to get a Lamborghini.
Right.
And if my buddy has a car dealership, well, I'm definitely going to go there. And if he wants to mark it up a little bit, well, it's the taxpayers' money. What do I care?
Right.
And so, you know, that's the nature, not necessarily the nature, but that's the, like, really basic watchdog requirement of government anywhere.
Right.
And you know, and so in a lot of ways, he's just another government agency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the $75 hammer of the Department of Defense or whatever it was, $1,000 hammer, like, you know, some historical known sort of government waste example. I mean, that needs to be monitored in all levels of government.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the meeting that you referenced that Sheriff Guzman will be attending is the Justice and Beyond meeting mm-hmm. next Monday, April the 4th. They run from 4:45 until about 7 p.m. And so the sheriff has been invited, I suppose. He gave a proposal to the planning committee and
no,
he accepted
it. Asked to go.
He asked to go at the planning committee and was accepted by the planning committee for him to be able to present before Justice and Beyond members. We have about 400 members now, and so it's open to the public, and that'll be from 4:45 until 7 p.m. I also will be there. I have some questions that I would like to get answered as well, and like mm-hmm. you have asked for documents more than a year ago now that were never produced. Mm-hmm. Seemed like it wasn't easy stuff, but it was stuff that needs to happen if there's accountability, transparency, and this is a public. I mean, he's an elected official, and the jail is paid, financed by public money. So these are obligations. These aren't, it's not a private, you know, group happening over there, right? I mean, these are obligations you need to meet to the public. So, and then I see that he's just on the news this morning asked for another $3 million for the jail, for emergency money from city council. To mitigate some of the problems that are happening over there. Again, like you said, trying to throw more money into the old jalopy, you know, as though that's going to make it better. Yeah, it may be we do need more money for the jail, but I definitely would like to see an itemized list of where that money is going to be spent. How is that money being used? If we don't have accountability mm-hmm. for that, then how do we know that it's just not going in the pockets of, like you said, the, you know, upper middle, you know, and upper echelons mm-hmm. of that agency and going nowhere?
And the city has to recognize that, you know, they have a homelessness program called the jail. They have a substance abuse program called the jail. They treat people you know, with mental illness with cages.
A workforce bad, problem yeah. or a workforce
unemployment,
program also
we have cages for that.
The jail, right?
Right. So it's just, you know, it's money being spent to deal with social problems
right.
and it's not being spent in a way that actually addresses those social problems.
Right.
So it works out great if you work for the jail. And you know, maybe it works out great if that's sort of like your political messaging. And that we sort of need to be tougher on people because they don't have jobs or something like that. And somehow that's going to, you know, solve the problem. But all that does is create a job for the person who's, you know, watching the cage. And it's really been gutting our society in this city more than any. And that's why last Monday we actually had to create, we've been working 4 years, the most revolutionary public housing policy in the country, which finally allows people to have a chance when they have a criminal record to go into affordable housing. And, you know, we have tens of thousands of people with criminal records in this city. It's really hard to figure. I mean, we have 7,000 in this very snapshot moment. But over the course of this year, you know, obviously it's probably close to double that because people are coming on and going off. And then if you think how many over the last 5 years, how many over the last 10 years, how many over the last generation. So, you know, it's at least 50,000 people. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if it was 100,000 people with criminal records in New Orleans. And then to say you can't live with your brother, you can't live with your mom, you can't live with your kids, you can't take care of your elderly parent because they live in Section 8. So this has been such a problem for a good, you know, I mean, there was a couple key federal initiatives in the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton administrations that really took away people's ability to live in public housing and get Section 8 vouchers. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And now you got a space where people, you know, word on the street is that if you have a felony conviction, you can't live there, period. It doesn't matter what the conviction is or how old it is. And the reality is people had tried to live there no matter what the conviction was and how old it was and been denied. And so all that discretion that they actually have had has turned into denial. And so we had to organize and, you know, vote and stand with dignity, really put together an organizing plan. And the elements of the city came around. A lot of great civil rights folks came to the table. NOFAC came around. Vera was a big part of middlemanning the whole operation. The probation and parole department was there testifying about this need. And, you know, eventually they capitulated. And one of our biggest demands at the end was this has to be binding on private developers because we've really privatized public housing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have to send the message, you know, that if you want these public dollars, if you want these contracts, if you want this free federal money to house people, well, then you have to follow these rules. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just like your money to do what you want. If you want to have your own development, charge whatever you want, let in whoever you want, and still be maybe subjected to some allegations of discrimination, you know, go do that. But if you want to get in the business of federal contracts and federal dollars, well, then you have to acknowledge that, you know, we have 80 million people in America with criminal convictions, and our police forces have targeted, intentionally targeted low-income people in communities of color, and people, you know, may roll their eye or raise an eyebrow when I say that, and I remind everybody to check themselves about where the most concentrated drug use in America is, or even in New Orleans. And, you know, here I am on the campus of Tulane. I guarantee you the most concentrated drug use in New Orleans is on Tulane.
Right.
And any students listening right now are probably chuckling. But it should be an embarrassed chuckle and a responsible chuckle. And I'm not even saying don't do drugs or whatever. I mean, do what you want to do. But what I'm saying is know that you're in a safe space and you are protected. And if Tulane police were to actually catch you, you'd more than likely get a slap on the wrist because clearly if they were to kick in the doors of dorms because of the smell of marijuana, which the Supreme Court said a couple years ago was legal, then you would have all these upper middle class wealthy white kids being arrested for drugs and the drug war would evaporate overnight.
Right.
But it's okay if you kick in the doors of a public housing project because you smell marijuana and you take an African-American or a Latino kid out of there or a parent or whatever and disrupt their entire families, and then you just call it, like, good public policy. Mm-hmm. And so we've clearly made these decisions as a community, and we've created the status quo. And then last week also we learned from one of Nixon's top domestic policy advisors, John Ehrlichman, who came clean to a writer and said, yeah, the drug war was always a fraud.
Right.
I mean, this is stuff where we all kind of gut instinct say, well, yeah, I kind of thought it was.
Right.
But to come clean and say, you know, we couldn't target the anti-war left hippies and we couldn't target black people, mm-hmm. but we could target heroin and marijuana and associate them with it and you know, police the hell out of it, and we could disrupt their communities. And it's worked like a charm.
Yeah, that's. Thank you so much for coming in. I hate to cut you off for a little bit. Fine. We're running late. I'm going to jump into democracy right away. And listeners, if you would like to know what's happening tonight around town, please go to WTUL New Orleans and check out our calendar. It's online.
They can go to our website as well, votenola.org, and get more information about the work that we're doing.
Yeah, and the Prison Industrial Complex NOLA to Angola newsletter calendar is also online on our Facebook page, W2L News and Views. You can access the calendar there. Please do visit Vote. Check out the documentary on Monday evening. What time does it start, Bruce?
At 7, we're going to be having a documentary. It's a 30-minute film. There'll be food. And then we'll have a panel afterwards with myself, Norris Henderson, and Leah Stern. And it's
great, great group of individuals. And as you mentioned, you know, it was your organization that put together a plan to allow people with former convictions to access decent housing and affordable housing. I want to remind listeners, it wasn't the city that came up with that plan. It was grassroots organizers, people that are, you know, in the trenches, people that really know these issues, came up with a plan and presented it to city council and the agencies that be, and that is the plan that's moving forward. So I can't overemphasize and stress enough how important it is to be involved in your life, in your community, in your family, and to you know, make sure that your needs and issues are being represented at all levels of government. So thank you so much for all the work you do. I'm going to have you back in again because, you know, I have so many more questions and I know you have so much wisdom to impart. So we're going to do that on another day. But right now we're going to jump into democracy now. And I just want to thank you so much again for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Janet. Thanks for having me in.